Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 39 featuring Tim Miller. Tim Miller is one of the founders of Blur Studio. He is a very interesting person. Blur Studio does things a little bit different than everyone else. He also happens to be the director of the upcoming movie Deadpool. And we talked to him about how that came about and what happens and what drives him. He has a very honest conversation with us and really sort of tells us his journey and what happened along the way for him. So it's really good to hear that. I also want to say that I'm recording this intro from Portugal. Today is the last day of Trojan Horse Was a Unicorn. It is an absolutely amazing event. The speakers here are outstanding. We love attending this conference. We were here last year just to check it out, and this year we were just so excited to come again. I really appreciate everything that was done for us here at Trojan Horse to make this thing possible. And we also happened to be lucky enough to be able to get some of the speakers to come and spend some time with us and talk to us and share their time. And I can't wait to share that with you guys. And I really want to thank the speakers for being able to give us their time as well. All right, guys, hopefully you enjoyed the podcast.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
No, not a lot.
Okay.
I listen to books on tape.
All right. Okay.
If I have time. Or read.
Or
read actual books.
Yeah.
Or Kindle.
Yeah. On my Kindle. Well, all the podcasts I do are very conversational, so I've actually just already started recording. So
oh. Yeah. Oh, shit.
You can curse. I don't care. At this point, I'm not going to stop you. I know it would be too hard for you.
Okay. Yeah, I can't do it.
So like it's all good.
It's like a Tourette's thing.
No, it's all good. It's funny. I actually started looking at books on tapes again myself because of my dyslexia.
Uh-huh.
It was like a freedom of like, oh, I can read again. And I read them while I drive. So it's amazing. It's been really good. And then podcast was the other
thing. Yeah, I'm a little stuck on these books by Joe Abercrombie that I actually optioned, called The Blade Itself. Is the first of them, and there's six of them. And this is kind of embarrassing to admit, but I've listened to the series 7 times all the way through. It's really crazy.
Wow, really?
But the guy that reads them is amazing. This guy named Stephen Pacey, who's a British actor. And he does just enough of the voices to make it, to distinguish the characters. And
right.
It's just amazing.
There is an art form to that.
I love this guy, yeah.
So how long? That must be what, like 100 hours or more?
Oh my God, I don't know. It's pathetic. It really is. I know these, I'm friends with the author, Joe, and and he's like, by this time, Tim, you know the books better than I do.
Right.
Just because I've lived them.
That's good. That's good. And you've optioned them at this point.
Yeah.
So that's great. And we've actually talked several times before. And yeah, I've actually done a little video here, which turned out really cool, I think.
And we actually send that out all the time. Like for people that go, oh, what's Blur like?
Right.
I just send them the link to that video.
Yeah, because I think it really, I try to make it very much like the answers that everyone gave me are authentic because they are, and they feel authentic, right? I don't feel like I'm forcing to get a quote out of them. They just, they kind of work with the flow. And the culture of this place is just really, really cool, which you've worked very hard on creating a culture for a place that's not really like any other visual effects place out there that I know of.
I might say I've tried to not work hard at it.
Okay.
If you know what I mean, because it's the goal was really to look, I think all artists are different, all people are different, and trying to create a kind of atmosphere with lots of rules and regulations that force people to behave in certain ways, that force them to work at certain times. Some artists work better from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m.
Right.
Some work better on a regular 9-to-5 schedule. And I always wanted to create a place where you could have that kind of flexibility that allows people to do what they work best at within reason, you know.
Sure.
Over the years, we've had to have more regulations and more structure than maybe I would like as an agent of chaos.
But, right.
but some is good, you know, and some people like structure. So I like to think that it's there for those who want it, and there's also enough flexibility that you can be freestyle if you want.
That's something definitely I notice when I talk to artists here, is that they feel very empowered by the ability to do what they want to do, or by the way they do things the way that they would like to do it, you know? So it is sort of one of the earliest studios to sort of embrace the power of the generalist in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it did it at a time where people were much more segregated. I mean, they were distinguishing, you know, hard surface modelers versus character modelers. Like, everything was broken down into specific idiosyncrasies that everyone might have. And Blur just sort of threw that away in a lot of ways. And I've sort of, what was the philosophy behind that? Where did that come from?
Well, I'd like to say it was a strategy that I thought long and deeply about and planned, but it's more, I mean, when we started, we were two artists and a producer, so
right.
We didn't have a whole lot of choice, really. I had to do everything. My partner, David, had to do everything.
Right.
But it really wasn't that different than, I think, a lot of people who had come up on the hobbyist side of things. I actually worked as a 2D compositor, was my day job,
mm-hmm.
and then I would go home, because I was interested in 3D, I bought my own software, and I ran it on a PC at home. Even though at work I worked on a very expensive high-end compositing box, you know, mm-hmm. that cost $1 million.
Right.
But then I would go home and do 3D in my spare time, and on the only machine that I could afford. So if you wanted to do anything, it wasn't like you could, you know, call up a team of guys to help
right.
you do something creative. So if you wanted it done, you had to do it yourself. And I think a lot of people that came up through that side of it, the desktop side of it, which was really just becoming possible, you know, in the early 90s when Blur was formed.
When was it formed? What year was that?
1995.
Okay.
And, you know, for the first few years, the prevailing wisdom was, if you were serious about 3D, you'd buy an SGI machine and
yep.
Alias, and, you know, suddenly you're $100,000 in debt.
Right.
And even 3 or 4 years into Blur, we would still have those people come by and say, listen, you know, now that Blur is an established company, maybe it's time you bought some real software. And I would go, yeah, right.
The software doesn't necessarily make you a better artist all the time.
Not at all.
And you were proving them wrong right from the start.
Well, I mean, there's stuff that we couldn't do.
Okay.
That it, in the early days, especially, where PCs were just not capable. The software running on PCs was not capable.
Right.
But, you know, you lived within your means, and gradually the tool set expanded and you mm-hmm. could do more and more projects. So it wasn't a bad thing. I mean, I felt like I could do 80% of what the high-end systems could do on my PC, and the other 20%, I'd
right.
leave it to them and somebody else could do it. Eventually we could do it all, but you know, at the beginning, you just had to be a little judicious about what you took on, because you don't want to fail, you know.
Right. Yeah. And what was the some of the early projects that you guys did? Because you've always had a history of sort of doing some amazing game cinematics, right? That's a lot of reputation. When people think Blur, they think amazing game cinematics, right? But obviously, you guys do commercials, and obviously now some big feature film work as well. But was that always the motivation? Was game cinematics? Was that something?
No, not at all. We fell into that quite by accident. That if I want to go up to 30,000 feet, the guiding principle was really just anything that interested me.
Mm-hmm.
And the medium was not that important. It could have been television. It could have been movies. I always loved movies, but I love movies because I love stories.
Right.
You can look at television nowadays and go, it's even better than movies because you get the chance to tell much more expansive stories.
Right.
So it was really anything that I could tell a story in, but ultimately I wanted to make movies. So the idea when we started the studio was really to to be able to choose a project on its artistic merit, not necessarily on how much money we were getting for it, not necessarily because it was a niche that we had developed and worked in. So the very, I don't think it was till maybe year two or three that we actually got our first game cinematic. And
oh, okay.
Yeah, and it was an accident. It was a game called Dark Reign, and mm-hmm. another company in San Francisco had been hired to do the cinematics, and it didn't work out for whatever reason. Right. So this guy, Trey Watkins, showed up and said, "Hey, I have a fraction of my budget left. I heard you guys don't totally suck. Would you be interested in yeah. trying to do something for yeah. it?" And which we did. And you know, we did Dark Reign, and we did Castle Wolfenstein, and a few others. And then we did the launch piece for Xbox, which Seamus Blackley, who was in charge of Xbox at Microsoft, mm-hmm. called and said, "Hey, I heard you guys are like the Navy SEALs of 3D Studio.
Nice.
You know, could you, I've got 2 weeks until Bill Gates is up in front of a news press event uh-huh. announcing this, and I need something, you know, splashy. And right. can you do it?" And of course, I go, "Yeah, fuck yeah.
Yeah, 2 weeks?
Yeah, no problem." Yeah. We did some crazy, I mean, we wouldn't do that kind of stuff now, which saddens me a little bit, but some of the projects like Warhammer, which is 40K, was one of my favorite projects. I mean, we had 3 weeks, and mm-hmm. and it's still, I still love it, but and you had a group of guys that are like, yeah, we're willing to bleed into our keyboards to right. make it happen because they were so excited about it.
Well, something also, you know, when you got those 2 or 3 week projects, you worked your ass off, but you know it's going to be over in 2 weeks. Yeah. So like the end's in sight. You're like, all right, it's going to be over in 2 weeks. I'm just going to make this happen, you know? And sometimes that's a good motivation. Just like, it's going to be painful, but it'll be over quick, you know?
Yeah. And I think there's so many factors in that. I mean, there's certainly that, but there's also like where you are in your career. If you're 26 right. and you're just out of school and full of fire and you want to prove yourself, you're going to work your ass off.
Right.
If you're with a group of guys where everybody else is like, fuck yeah, let's do yeah. this. We're going to step up. You want to be in that group. If you're passionate about the project and you really believe in it creatively, you want to be, you're willing to die for it.
Right.
So all of those factors. And I think, you know, in the early years, Blur had this reputation as kind of a sweatshop.
Mm.
But in my mind, it was okay because it was never for the money. It was always because we wanted to do more creatively than our clients were willing to pay us for. So,
right.
so we ended up just working a lot of hours to make it great.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt bad for that, and it does build a lot of camaraderie. This is a bad metaphor, but in any extreme experience, the people you go through, like war, is
right.
a good one. Is the most obvious one where, you know, people band together because they've got this shared yeah. experience that is in some way traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some fucking traumatic burns, some
right.
really epic
right.
burns. Back in the day where you'd be sleeping here for a week and you'd get 4 hours if you're lucky, and then
right.
you'd be back at it. But that's what you do.
Yeah. And it is a bonding experience, and it's not necessarily something to look forward to, but the memory of it actually stays with you a little bit. And then the product is like, if it's a good product, which it usually is in the situations, you're like, yeah, that was hard, that was good, and that I worked my ass off, and there's pride in that, even
totally.
After all the pain and everything else that happened.
Can you look back on your life and think of anything that you're really proud of that was easy?
Yeah.
It's almost like if it's easy, you're not going to be proud of it.
Right.
It's not going to make an impression, and you're going to forget about it
right.
and move on.
Yeah.
People want to be challenged. Artists want to be challenged.
Yep.
You know? So, and the tricky thing is as the company grows in size, it becomes less of a place where I'm sitting next to and sharing the pain of every person on every project.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's different projects, and these guys are burning, but these guys are not. And it becomes a little bit more of a company and less personal. And
right.
that's both good and bad. I would say mostly bad, but,
okay.
but there's good to it too. You know, you don't, you also, we learned this lesson really around, I guess, year 7 or 8 is you, we had guys quitting because, you know, we had this sort of atmosphere of machismo where, you know, we're all going to suffer together. And so when people got tired of the burn after burn, for 5 or 6 years, they would quit because they didn't want to admit that they wanted to take their foot off the pedal. And, mm-hmm. and we really had to change our way of looking at it. So people didn't feel like they had to quit if they needed a break. They could just say, hey, I need to sit this one out, or I need to work regular hours for a while. I can't go in 120% on this next project.
Do you think there was a lot of that they felt that they were peer pressured in order to do that?
I do. And I think I had a lot to do with that. Mm. I think, you know, I am not immune from that sort of locker room crap that I'll be the first to admit that I would go, you fucking pussy.
Right. Yeah.
But I wasn't trying to be mean. It was just,
but let's,
that was kind of the world I grew up in of guys give each other shit.
Yeah.
And maybe it wasn't smart.
But you're very different, right? So like this is your company's different, but you're also very different about how you run the company, right? You sit in a big room where all the artists are at a desk, just like any other artist. And you put yourself there for a reason so that, from my point of view, I've never worked at Blur, but I'm looking at this and I'm saying, there's a guy who's saying, I'm approachable. I'm one of you guys. You can talk to me about anything you want. Is that why you do it? Or what's the motivation behind doing that? Because a lot of people won't do that. They want the cushy office, right?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that I sit on the floor in the open floor plan in general is, I feel like it keeps everyone honest. If I've gone to some other companies and where I've worked, you know, if people have cubicles, they tend to shut themselves off.
Oh, yeah.
There's
I've worked
been so
at the same cubicles. I never talk to anyone.
Yeah, people shut the doors and all you hear is tap, tap, tapping. And I don't think it's a fun place to work, but I also don't think learning happens or shared knowledge happens in the same way as it does when, I mean, just when I walk to the bathroom, I'll see stuff on people's monitor and I'll go, hey, wait a second, you're not supposed to be working on that shot, or, oh man, I had an idea for that. Or how did you just do what I saw you do there?
Right.
Teach me. And I don't think that can happen if you have cubes. But for me, I mean, why I sit out there was just because I was a guy doing the work on the box originally, and I didn't want to be in an office. I wanted to be with I wanted to be with all the artists because those are my friends, and that's who I like being around. And it's the same way now. Now, you know, it's a little different, and every once in a while I have to go take a phone call in another room. But, but it's not that bad.
Well, a lot's changed recently as well, so it's going to be.
Yeah, but
you seem to be keeping yourself honest in that way.
Well, the nice thing about getting your dream at 50 is, hopefully, if you're about as much of an asshole as you're going to be,
right?
You know, I feel incredibly fortunate to finally get to direct a film, but see, I get choked up and when I talk about it. But I also cry.
I'm going to make you cry.
I cry very easily.
I'm going to cry too.
Everybody tells you I know I cry all the time, but never for pain.
Only no. There's a friend of mine. She says, don't cry because there's only two things. If someone cries or throws up, then I immediately cry or throw.
We were doing some ADR the other day, which involved vomiting. Uh-huh. And I cannot stay in the room. I got to go in another room while the guy does it because I can't listen to it because it makes me sick. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, I just like working among the guys. I was saying about being 50 and getting what you want. I don't take it very seriously. It's great that it happens, and I'm grateful for it. But at the same time, you know, I'm not curing cancer here.
No.
I'm not solving world hunger. I'm directing a film, and there is really no need for ego in that process. It takes a village, and this is a team sport more than any other.
Yep.
And so, why act like you're too special?
Right.
Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to talk about some of your influences.
Sure.
What are some of the things that influenced you in terms of your style or your what would you say is part of the influence in your life that has created blur the way it is? And that could be the creative influence or anything else you feel.
You know, originally I my father read a lot, and so I read a lot, and he was kind of a communist, maybe mm-hmm. socialist is more of a term for it, and a term for what he believed, and I just felt this affinity to create a group dynamic where artists could work together in a group and not really feel the oppression of a heavy hierarchy or the boss or the man. Mm-hmm. And so I really, when we started Blur, we purposely said, everybody's equal. I wanted to do some crazy shit, like post everybody's salaries on the wall.
Right.
And for the first 5 years, everybody made the same. Everybody made $1,000 a week for the company. And we were hiring sort of senior people. And I like that. I like it when it's transparent. I like when everybody knows what's going on. I sort of have this assumption that everybody finds that shit out eventually, you know, whether it's a pay stub is in the trash can or an apartment application in the copier. And so I just wanted to be as transparent about all that stuff as possible and really create an atmosphere where that was true. So I guess my dad taught me that. Mm-hmm. And that was always the kind of the way he worked with he ran a company that didn't have as many employees as us, but you know, had 20 people, and he treated it all like a big family, and I wanted to do the same thing. And then artistically, it's just for me that I think there are people who are visual stylists. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those guys. I appreciate it. I mean, I look at Fincher's work, for instance, and I go, holy shit. There's just an attention to style and detail that I know I'm never going to achieve. But I've always been more interested in story and character.
Okay.
Not that David's not, but I'm just saying, for me, that's always what it's been about. So
yeah.
My love came from books, and then it was comics because I loved to draw, and comics became the perfect blend of story and art. And that's kind of where my influence came together. And then when I went to college, it was illustration and animation, because animation is really just pictures that move and tell stories. So it was a pretty logical progression.
What did
me.
You go to college for? What did you study?
I got a BA in animation.
And animation?
In illustration.
And where was that?
Virginia Commonwealth University.
Yeah, that's a good school.
Had a good time.
Yeah, yeah.
I was on the 5-year plan. I went to a little college the first year and then transferred to VCU.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Now, and you obviously your comic book passion is clearly visible right here on this gigantic wall here.
He's pointing to a giant wall of nerd I have in the studio.
Yeah, and that wall is pretty influential, and obviously you've had some interest in creatively in the comic book style. You guys did the goon thing a while ago, which was really cool. I love the style. I love the story of it. One of the things I thought was interesting about it is that you're going to take comic books and you'll sort of almost pay homage to some of the other animations Heavy Metal. Like, you know, those are like animations that are like, these are not for kids necessarily, you know, this is for a different maturity level. But you brought in a lot of humor and other things involved in the Goon stuff that was pretty, pretty cool. So that's been something that I've noticed about, you know, obviously we're going to talk about Deadpool as well, but you kind of like that a little bit raw feeling in the storytelling, right?
Yeah, I mean, I love animation, and it's funny that I'm directing a live action film because I always consider myself an animator first and foremost.
Right.
But I didn't want to tell stories for kids. Mm-hmm. I have enormous respect for Pixar and DreamWorks and the companies that make those bigger films. Some of them are beautiful, and films like The Incredibles or Iron Giant, they're on my top film list no matter what medium they were made with. But anyway, I just I always loved stories that were a little bit more adult. And it's funny you mentioned heavy metal. I'm sure you did that on purpose. But you know, that was a big influence in 1981. Mm-hmm. I think it came out in 81. No, it came out in 81. So I was going to midnight movies.
Yeah.
And for the first time, you see, okay, shit, this doesn't have to be for kids. I can do this. I can make these kind of movies.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be for kids, which felt, you know, a little stifling to me.
Right.
So I always wanted to do that. And then I thought animation, you know, when I first got on the computer, I thought, oh my God, this is the greatest art tool ever. Mm-hmm. And particularly for animation. And back then, you know, nobody had really thought Toy Story was still several years away.
Right.
And it just didn't seem to most people like a viable story creation tool for features. But
right.
But I knew it was going to be. And I knew eventually we'd get around to telling adult stories. When right. Final Fantasy came out, I wanted to cry because the first attempt at an animated adult film
right.
was A, ridiculously expensive, and right. B, terrible.
Right.
And, you know, it flopped. And I knew its flopping would be blamed on the fact that it was animation and adult.
Right.
Instead of the fact that it just wasn't a very good story.
I still think it is. Yes, it did flop and they had a lot of problems and everything else, but I still think it is an amazingly important movie in the industry. I think it's one of the most important ones because one, it was not a Pixar thing again, you know, not to right. knock it, because I think Pixar, again, like you said, is great. But back then it was hard, and there was an important part of digital humans that started to happen around that time where, okay, how far, we can't push this and why? And just asking those questions, and a bunch of really interesting things happened around that time, and the quality and the hair, and they pushed the envelope of what was possible. And yes, they stumbled and they failed, but I think if they hadn't done that and they hadn't looked at a medium that's different, we wouldn't be doing some interesting things that we do now, you know? And I think that some of the things that are let's just look at some of the cinematics that you guys do, and it's like they're breathtaking, right? And they're not for little kids. No.
Some are.
And the Goldfish stuff's great. I love that. You know, and some of it is really cool, but they're absolutely amazing. And it's interesting, based on your idea of story, we looked at your reel recently, right?
My personal reel?
No, the blur reel that's out now.
I don't have a personal reel. Yeah. I have a personal reel.
No, the blur reel. And it's absolutely gorgeous. It's a wonderful reel. And we know the content of it, but you could have put that content in any specific way. But you did it in a way that's telling a story. It's a very subtle story, but it's a five-act reel that has all the different parts to it. Has the introduction to the characters, has all the chaos, the climax, the downfall, and the reclimax, and the winning at the end. It's all there. People may not realize it, but the way it breaks down into the music, it's all exactly right. And I can't think that's an accident, because I haven't seen reels built that way for a reason.
Well, I wish I could take credit for that, but I can't. I mean, that was an editor we worked with, Jaron Pitts, we basically just said, here's all our shit.
Right.
Make something great.
Yeah.
And I really it's one of my favorite reels. I used to cut the reels myself. And,
right.
And I'm glad I don't anymore. There's people better
at it.
It's
a lot of work. Yeah.
But he just did such an amazing job. But I think in that one in particular, you really notice, like, I remember the first time I watched that reel, I walked away with not the thing that you did. I walked away with, oh my God, our fucking characters are great.
Yes.
Our characters look so good. Mm-hmm. And they're conveying emotion and power, and animated so
well. But it does
well,
it in an order that you are invested into it. I'm watching a reel and I'm invested in a character, and it's so well done. It's so beautiful. And it's just emotionally, it's overwhelmingly emotional. First thing I look at is like, well, this reel is going to be 5 minutes long. It's like, hope it can keep my attention. I was like, I'm glued to it the whole time, because it was so great. And you,
well, thank you.
You guys have,
but I didn't do it.
I know. You guys have so much good work to put in there that it really, that's what makes it happen. Anyway, our reel, which we did this year, I made our editor and our composer watch that reel, oh, your really? Reel, and say, our reel needs to follow a formula that makes sense like this, because that's the way we have to tell a story, in the same way that Blur did. So
I just thought it was cool to have somebody that was that, you know, usually, like I said, it was me or one of our supervisors right. occasionally editing the reel. But to have somebody to come in and
just look at a fresh,
look at our work in a different way than we do, because you know, it tends to get a little insular.
Yeah,
My wife,
like, let's put this shot in there because I really love it, but exactly. it may not work, right?
Exactly. And my wife, who is also a creative director here and really runs the company, but but she, you know, it's the same thing. We get inside of our heads where it's when you go outside, and we all look at everybody else's work, but there's an arrogance, I guess, about your own work that tends to creep in. And it's really interesting when somebody else comes in and said, you know, this thing that you thought was the best work, that's not really the best work. It's this thing over here.
Right.
Or maybe it's this other company
right.
That did stuff. But because there used to be no competitors. Now there's a lot of people doing great work.
Yeah.
Competition's a lot stiffer.
You guys are finding a way to stand out, I think, in a lot of different ways. And I don't think, you know, other companies may do things that are better, than, et cetera, but if there's still stuff that you guys do that no one else is doing and no one else is able to do, I think.
Well, I would say that I think for the time that we have it, you know, we get compared to companies like Blizzard and Digic all the time. Mm-hmm. And they do brilliant work. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, I know a little bit about their pipelines, and I think we do a little more with a little less.
Right.
And I'm proud of that, although you can't follow your reel around and say, hey, those guys had more time, or, oh, yeah, well, yeah, it's better, but they had more money than us. So. Yeah.
Well, you're still managing to do it, and you're doing it in Los Angeles as well, so you're obviously doing something right.
Which is tricky, you know?
Yeah, it is tricky.
Yeah.
It's tricky. I know that you guys are probably feeling the pressure, but you've managed to stay here as long as this, and there's amazing amount of artists that you guys have been able to work with here. So I think it's really cool. I like the fact that the artists feel very empowered by what they do. So,
I mean, look, at the end of the day, you want it to feel like a family. And the hard thing is over the years, I mean, we're at about, I don't know, 85 mm-hmm. staff right now. We've been everywhere from, you know, 110 to 85 to, like, when we were doing Halo last year, we got up to like 160, including freelancers. So,
right.
We've been in a lot of different sizes, and I would say that 75% of the people that come through are appreciated. They're very grateful, and they like the atmosphere, and they're happy and content. And then you have the other 25 who are, you know, they complain and they whine, and why don't we have a masseuse every other Friday, and why doesn't Blur pay for that? And we had two artists leave from the same department about a month ago. And we do these things where they do a little exit interview, and they say, this is what I think about the company, and they answer these questions that are really, we do to try and find out, you know, basically, where do we fuck up, or mm-hmm. where are we doing right? And one of these artists, literally, it sounded like he led a hellish existence in a bleak and artistically barren environment, where he was not allowed to creatively express himself, where he was either given too much direction or too little. And it made me feel horrible for, mm-hmm. like, oh my God, I run a company where somebody could feel like this. And then I read the exit interview from another guy who literally sat next to him, and he said, one of the best companies I've ever worked for. It was a dream come true. I loved it. Blur treated me well. They
right.
provided for my family. And it could not have been a sharper contrast. And for every one of these that, you know, takes a little chip out of your soul,
right.
you know, there's one of those that or maybe three of those, really, that
right.
you feel like, okay, well, they picked up what I was trying to put down.
Yeah, yeah.
They got it. But I still feel like, fuck, there should be a way to reach everybody,
you let
right?
this person down?
Yeah, I do. I do feel like every person that leaves, I feel like I let them down. And there's been so many that have left over the years, you know, because I always try and talk them out of it. I always go,
But most of the people you have stay longer than most people at other companies that I've seen.
It's true. Yeah, we have a core staff that's very loyal.
Right.
We have we have, you know, people that come in.
I mean, a lot of people I know, they're like 9 months, new company, 9 months, new company.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. Yeah. It drives me a little crazy. And I do feel like I've failed when people leave.
Right.
But in I don't know how many we've had over the year. Let's say it's 150 over 20 years that have left.
Right.
Every time I try and talk them out of it, you know how many times I've succeeded? Zero.
Right.
They never talk them out of it. And sometimes they call me back. I had one guy that left 2 years ago that had some issues with me, and he came back recently, and I hadn't seen him since. And he made a point of coming over to me, and he's like, oh, Tim, I got to tell you, man, I thought you were an asshole when I left, but, you know, I've found out that there are a lot bigger assholes out there than you. And, you know, I just wanted to tell you that. And I'm like, thanks?
Yeah.
there's bigger assholes?
Right.
But, you know, I guess I try and play the averages there, and
yeah,
and most of the people here are glad to have been here. So
yeah,
I'll put that in the plus column.
That's good. I think you should. Like I said, it's like, you're not going to make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Right. So
yeah, you can't make everybody happy.
Yeah, and you can't, and it's like, you know, when sometimes if you, and I put a video out there, right, on something that V-Ray did or whatever, and someone puts down, it's like, still not as good as Corona. It's like, why do I care? yes. Oh boy, now you've put me down. Like, I can't deal with trolls or people who don't like stuff. You know, negative comments are not going to should not be affecting me, right? So that's what I think is a good one. But anyway, I want to something that's come up. I've had several people on the podcast that have recently or in the past gotten movie deals, right? Figured out how to do it, right? So Roy Robinson was on.
Nah, I wouldn't say figured out, but yeah. Go ahead.
No, but no one's figured it out. It's always going to be something. But Roy Robinson was on, Wes Ball was on, it was on last week. And there's a thing that has been going on where people are talking about the way to get a studio's attention is different than it used to be. And Rory specifically, you know, when he put Leviathan, he knew he was going to put it out on the internet before it sort of goes out to a bunch of people and stuff. But what are some of the things that you've discovered? Obviously, you got Deadpool. It was based on the fact it had been sitting for a while, and then the public said that they wanted to see this movie because it leaked out somehow, right?
Right.
So What do you think is changing in the dynamic? Because this is happening more often.
Or is it, though?
I don't know. Well, I'm noticing it.
I mean, I know Rory, and, you know, he was here for 6 months while he was finishing Leviathan.
Right.
And I know Wes, too, and he got his thing set up from Ruin, which was a great short. But the thing is, I mean, I think you could look at it with Rory, you could look at it with me, too, where that's not the first short film that Rory did. He won for
50%. No, he didn't win.
Or he got nominated for 50% Grey, right? Yeah. And he did some other short films, and they get a lot of attention. And, you know, a few years ago, a guy did Panic Attack, and it got a lot of stuff. And our own Kevin Margot got a shitload of praise and approval for his shorts.
And then there's this guy at Post Panic that did Sundays, and they did the same thing. But
and not, Pixels was a short film too, so it certainly happens. But I guess I don't look at that as a way that it happens. I mean, Deadpool, the piece we did, leaked, but it's the fifth film that I've had set up to develop at different studios. It just happened to be,
but do you think
one that I never gave, I don't give up on any of them, but
but do you think it would have happened if it didn't, if the public didn't say, oh my God, I want to see this? If the public didn't say that, do you think the movie would have gotten made
gotten picked? No, I don't. I think that making films, even at a relatively safe budget, is still a risky business. It's still a lot of money. And you know, you want to take as much risk off the table as you can.
Right.
The way the fans reacted to that leaked test, which I swear on a stack of whatever you want to bring me, I still don't know to this day how it leaked or who leaked it.
Sure.
But I think when they see that the public responds to it that way, there's a lot more comfort in the fact that there's something that people want to see. You know, it's not, you don't have to guess that,
right?
Oh my God, if I make a movie about travel in the fourth dimension through a wormhole, will people want to see it? You don't have to guess. You can test the waters and you see.
Right.
People want to see it.
Yeah, and I think it's a good place to start, to be honest. I think, because here's the risk, right? The risk that probably, what was the well, when obviously that test had been out for a long time before it leaked, right? And the studios sort of were not necessarily
in. 4 years.
4 years. So they were probably thinking, an R-rated superhero movie, not sure. Public probably won't like it. I don't know how many people. So you basically answered that question, or that question got answered after the leak happened, right? So they were like, oh, maybe the public is ready for this, right?
Yeah.
So that...
And to be fair, I mean, I think it was a different time.
Right.
Four years ago, yep. It was not as many superhero movies had come out. Right. Not as many had done so well. And maybe the feeling was that there was still a deep well of general audience superhero films to be mined before you had to offer audiences something different.
Right.
You know? I think people are excited about Deadpool because of the character, for sure, but also it's just something different. The same reason they got excited about Guardians of the Galaxy. It was not Avengers. It was not Captain America. It was something very different, and it had a lot of humor, and it had new characters that people didn't really know about, and I think people believe enough in the Marvel brand that they're willing to give it a chance, whereas if somebody else had done it, maybe not.
Right.
I think the film would have still been successful because it was a good film. Chris Pratt's a funny fucking guy.
But, yeah.
But I don't know if it would have been successful on the same scale. I don't know if you can take it out of time and say, if I had leaked it 4 years ago, would it have made a difference? I don't think 4 years ago.
No.
I don't think it would have.
I think the timing is very critical. Obviously, it was the right time that it accidentally came out, that the public got attention, because I think, you know, that's a good thing.
There's also different management at Fox at the time.
Yeah.
There was a different group of folks there.
I love the fact that and it is going to be R-rated. They've made too much publicity over this.
Yes. Definitely. R-rated.
Yeah, I figured there's just no way around it at this point. I'm extremely excited about it. So the other thing, obviously, that I want to talk about is, how was Comic-Con, by the way, this year?
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I know there's a fan base for Deadpool, and based on the teaser, I knew people would be excited about it, but I had no idea that was going to happen. I would have been happy with a small fraction of that and counted myself fortunate and successful, so... It was completely surprising. And it took everybody by surprise. Fox
it
was,
did.
Everybody was backstage, and we didn't expect it. Even Ryan was standing next to me on stage when which honestly, when you're standing up there, is really just...
You were at Hall H, right?
Yeah, it's just a roar of voices and light, and it's hard to really make out what's happening. So it took a few minutes to realize that they were chanting to have the film show again, or maybe it just seemed like a few minutes, maybe it was only a few seconds, but it was a really sort of overwhelming, confusing wave of emotion that led to that. And we were, you know, generally surprised. Yeah. Ryan was actually making a comment about in my ear as the audience, he's going, "See, I knew they would love that shot." He was like talking about a particular shot in the movie, not even thinking, like, we weren't really aware that there was this huge swell of emotion from the crowd beyond a, you know, a general feeling.
It was a talk of the thing. I didn't go to it, but it was a amazing talk. And what was funny is, you know, one of the podcasts I listen to all the time is the Nerdist podcast. A lot of my listeners know that. And Chris Hardwick was the host of that event. And so he talked about just chatting, like he has this podcast where it's just him chatting with his buddies, right? And they were talking about Comic-Con, and he was like, "Oh yeah, yeah, and let me tell you about Deadpool." And he just goes on about how surprised everyone was by how great it. Not that they didn't think it was good or not. They just like the react. I think what he mentioned was the crowd was surprised. The crowd was shocked by how much they liked it. It wasn't there like, "Okay, we're gonna see Deadpool." Like, No, oh, let's see Deadpool. Okay, that seems cool. Oh my God, let me see that again. And so,
well, I mean, maybe like you're saying, you didn't think it was going to really be R-rated.
Right.
Maybe they didn't really think that we were going to deliver something that was indicative of what the comic's about
right.
until they saw it.
So now
they were trying really hard.
Seeing is believing it.
Yeah. I mean, look, I love the comic, and I think Hollywood gets this rap of changing things because properties enter the system, the studio system, and inside, maybe they know it and love it. Maybe they don't. But there's people that, they're because of their role, their voices need to be heard in the process. Sometimes that's not the right voice for this property, and things go askew. So I think the audience has a real trepidation about things getting twisted by people that don't know the property. In this case, you know, Ryan loves it. The writers love it. I love it, and we wanted to be true to it. You fall in love with something for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go and change it.
Right.
After that, you try and say, this is why I love it, and let me just translate it to this new medium. So that's what we tried to do. You know, on the other hand, you do have to, you can't make it for the super hardcore
right.
fans, because it's not going to make enough money, and nobody will see another one
right.
after that, because they won't make it.
Right.
At the end of the day, it's a business.
Well, sometimes it's not always the right idea to do that. You know what I mean? I mean, it was kind of like one of the criticisms about the Star Trek, you know, friend with J.J. Abrams in it. It's like, this is not your normal Star Trek, right? I don't think it's wrong to do what he did, though. I mean, that style, I think, is like completely viable and certainly enjoyable. It doesn't have to follow the traditional Star Trek style, right?
No, no. I mean, everybody is, I think, when something new is done, I'm not saying that I'm doing it, but when something new is done well, people get excited about
right.
it, and there's more than one way to do anything. I mean, look, I look at the Deadpool trailer, and I liked it, of course, but
right.
I didn't go into it thinking, holy shit, I created a fucking masterpiece.
Right,
and,
no.
And the roof is going to collapse on Hall H. I went into it going, and Ryan too, all of us were like, wow, I hope people like it.
yeah.
We like it. And then we were really so grateful for the
yeah.
response.
Yeah, what that was. So I would have loved to have been there, but I think my phobia of standing in line.
Oh yeah, I mean, you have to stand. And I haven't missed Comic Con in 20 years.
Right.
Ever since I moved to LA,
I've
gone down every year, and it used to be so great because you could go down and I could go to Hall H, and I could go to all the panels.
Mm-hmm.
And I would literally spend a few hours on the floor, and then I'd go to panels all day.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that anymore.
You
either, for the big ones like Hall H, you got to wait overnight. But even for smaller TV shows, you know, you still got to wait 3 or 4 hours. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And sort of sad, because you want the fans to be able to participate. It's great.
And just sad because they're just basically sitting out in the hallway.
You know? I know. And, you know, people make the best of it and they talk to their friends. But
sure.
you can't go from, I would literally plan my day around the panel. I'm going to go from this one to this one. And, okay, maybe I'll be a little late and I'll miss the intro, but I'll still get to see it.
Right.
But you can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, the really best thing about Comic-Con was, well, it's not the best thing. The reaction of Hall H was the best thing. But getting to see, we had nice little family on the set, and getting to see TJ and Ryan and Morena and
right.
Ed, love that fucking guy.
Yeah.
And Brianna and Gina, we all had such a great time hanging together. And then a lot of the other folks were there.
And like, you didn't have to worry John about shooting a movie. You could just hang out, right?
Yeah. And it was, you get a lot of time to hang out when you're yeah. on a set.
Sure.
It was just great to, I originally didn't have to do any interviews, and they were doing all the interviews, and I said, I'm just going to go to a few and heckle. And then I ended up just hanging out in all of them, just because I got to hang out with them in between. And it was a lot of fun.
Cool.
I like them all.
Well, that's great. How long was the shoot for?
If you count just the shoot, it was 50 days.
That's not very much.
No.
Yeah.
It was very, very aggressive.
That is very aggressive. That's less than, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Okay. And
I mean, we had a good prep period, though. So,
so you guys really, really knew.
Yeah, we really prepared as much as I can. I mean, first time director, I so much shit I don't know. And
how was your AD? He had a, probably had a really solid AD.
Oh, he was great.
AD.
Yeah. James Batanti.
Okay.
He great sense of humor.
Good.
Was just enough of a dick.
Yeah.
To,
yeah, well, you have to be.
Keep everybody on track.
Yeah.
And but everybody, you know, Ken Sang was my DP and James, and they were also, and Ryan too, because, I mean, Ryan's done so many films, but I made no bones about not knowing large chunks of the process. And I'm like, look, if I'm doing something stupid, tell me.
Right.
If I should be doing something differently, please tell me. If I'm making a huge mistake, please tell me.
Right.
And they were all very great about doing that. And I think it worked really well because there was that atmosphere of, there was no ego about it.
Sure.
It was really just everybody loved the script and just wanted to make the best film
possible. Well, I've been on set a whole bunch, and a lot of times, you know, as first time directors are out there, and it happens all the time. That's, there's actually a reason that why people like first time directors, because they bring a fresh story, a fresh idea, or whatever it's going on. But that's why you have an AD, right? An AD comes in there is like, all right, I like your vision. This is how we can execute it, and this is how we're going to schedule it, right? And make it work out. Works out really well. And if you have that person, you have that trust in that person, then you can continue to focus on what you're there for, which is your vision and how you want it to happen. And so that's a good team will empower you that.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I really think that, again, doing it at 50 versus 30, not that you can't, there's lots of great filmmakers that do it at that age, brilliant filmmakers. For me, it was better that I waited. Not that I waited on purpose, but it was better that it happened later, because I feel like the experience of running the company, it's a stressful thing, but I never felt stressed out or out of control. And I think it's because you run a company, it's dealing with people, it's managing artists, it's trying to get everybody to work together towards a common goal.
Right.
And on a movie set, it was very much the same. It's a lot of people management. And I think there's a system. I think there's a lot of directors out there that maybe aren't the best at dealing with people. And there's a whole system built around allowing them to not deal with people.
Right.
It was nice that it didn't have to be that way for me, and I could actually talk to people. And
right.
We never, you know, I never lost my shit, never yelled at anybody. I don't think there's a need for that.
Right.
But it happens.
Sure.
Very often.
It happens because you've got a specific thing and you're running out of time, and you feel like you're gonna lose the opportunity to get what you want out of this, because that shot's never gonna be right because I never did it. We never went through these things, and I'm gonna have to live with that, right?
Right.
I was always that fear. I remember, you know, when I was on set as a VFX soup, and they're like, okay, you got 5 minutes. Like, great, I got 5 minutes to do something that's going to affect me for the next 2 months.
Yeah.
And it's really scary. You got to make a choice then and there. Like, how am I going to do this as fast as possible, but I get absolutely everything I need? And it's the same thing when you're shooting, right? It's like, I better get this scene right, because that's my chance, my only chance, right?
Right. But if you don't, or if something goes wrong, you just got to put it behind you and move on to the next thing. And
hopefully editing can fix it or whatever. Yeah.
Look, there was not a day that I walked off the set thinking, oh my God, I'm awesome. I got everything I wanted. Every day I walked out thinking I could do so much better. I should have been smarter here. I really made a mistake here. Why didn't I realize this was fucking up? But it was, you know, every day I got a chance to do it again and to try and make amends and learn. So I really enjoyed that. I mean, it was the most intense experience of my life, but one of the best by far. And again, you know, at being a little older, I didn't feel like I had to stay out all night and drink with the cast. I didn't feel like I had to party relentlessly. It allowed me to have a small amount of self-control and really focus on the work instead of, you know, the social aspect of it all.
Right. Well, that's cool. I mean, like I said, I think it's a really amazing thing. And, you know, I think it's inspirational, because if it happened to you at 50, it could happen to someone else at 50 too. Like, a lot of people, you know, they look at these young directors like, oh, he's 29 and he's directing his first big feature. And it's defeating to hear that, you know?
I was one of those guys. It's hard not to be. And I'm widely known for being petty. so it was really hard to not to read about those guys and go, you know, even Wes, who is like the nicest fucking guy in the world, yes. You know, I read about it and I go, God, fucking, how did he do that?
He's so nice. Yeah. Hate him.
He's so good and talented and young. And but you know, that's not, it's just not the way,
no,
it's just not the way it goes. And I'm just glad I got the chance eventually. I do think that, you know, back to your earlier question, I certainly think that anything you can do that can show people what you're capable of is a good thing. And I think shorts are a great way to get attention. I also think on the other side, having been in development on quite a few projects, there's just such a daunting array of things that, I mean, heavy metal is a good example where, yeah. I mean, we had the rights to it. We developed 28 amazing stories. Mm-hmm. David Fincher was going to direct one. Jim yeah. Cameron was going to direct one. Yep. Zack Snyder was going to direct one.
Yeah.
All committed, and we couldn't get a studio to take it.
Yeah.
It just, we tried for 3 years. David and I took, I shit you not, 100 meetings to try and get that movie made. Because I love movies and I love long form storytelling, but short stories, what an amazing idea. It's all meat, no fat. You just get in there and tell the story. I thought of Blur could be this creative hub where other directors could come in and plug in for a little while,
yep.
tell a story, execute their vision. We would tee it up for them. It would have been amazing. Heavy metal would have been the dream project for me in so many ways. And when I was developing it to pitch, you know, we developed these 28 stories, all had their own artwork. It was the happiest 3 months of my life, I think, because every day was like Christmas where I'd get in artwork from all these concept artists that were helping us to flesh out these stories visually. And it was just terrific. But we just couldn't sell it because, again, you go into the studios and you have all those heavyweight names, but it's R-rated, animation, anthology. And mm-hmm. those are three things that have never been successful
right.
by themselves, much less as a group. And
well, maybe the timing is just going to be, you have to wait for the right timing. And maybe it wasn't the right time, you know?
Maybe. So yeah, we'll maybe say. It'll be again. But I really wanted to. There was something about, something really nice and cyclical about trying to inspire a new generation that animation can tell different kinds of stories
yeah.
the way I had been inspired by the original.
Yeah, I think you're not a unique person in this world, right? I don't think so. And I think there's a lot of people.
What?
No, no
what
you're
do you
not.
Mean by that?
No, but I mean, your tastes, like there are other people who like the kind of things that you do, right? And
oh,
I think
totally.
And I think that that's gonna happen. And I think also there are some people out in the world out now who have never seen heavy metal, right? Heavy metal, not many people have necessarily seen that movie. That, you know, you can't go to someone on the streets like, have you ever seen Heavy Metal? And like, the chances that person saw it are going to be a little bit slimmer,
yeah,
right?
True.
But
yeah.
but also I bet that there's a bunch of people that you go on the street and you show them Heavy Metal and go, oh my God, I didn't know that ever existed or that was possible. And I think, imagine that even outside the United States, you know, it could be huge.
Oh, I there's no doubt it would have been, it would have been huge.
Yeah.
I think it was an epic failure of vision
right.
that we weren't allowed to make it. Because if I do say so myself, we had some great stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just stuff from the magazine. It was, I went to all my favorite science fiction authors and fantasy authors and comic book authors. And I mean, fuck, we had Brian Bendis and Steve Niles and Neil Asher and Joe Haldeman and... Mm. It was just Lucius Shepard and Mark Laidlaw. All these guys did stories for us, and we had beautiful visuals to match. It would have
right.
been an orgasmic, stylistic animation experience.
Right.
It really would have been, but, you know,
that's
I'll do
okay.
it someday.
You'll do
Maybe
it
won't be heavy metal because
yeah.
they've got new owners and it's not our thing anymore, but I still think animated anthology would be an amazing.
Yeah.
An
well,
amazing
we'll see.
Thing.
I mean, at this point, you're proving that you can direct things and you can have good vision. You're proving that things that people didn't think were possible
Yeah, but I mean, seriously, man, if David Fincher, Zack Snyder, and Cameron can't get it going, then
When was that?
Yeah.
When was that?
Yeah, it was a few years ago.
Okay, so things are changing. That's what I'm trying to say. It's like, you know, and you those names can come back and they can do different things. I mean,
timing is different, right? Timing is very important.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I was saying about the studio and whether or not something, and I'm sure Wes would have said the same about Ruin. I mean, there's that gets you in the door. Ruin is what got him in the door at Fox. Right. Ultimately, that's not what he directed.
You know,
it was Maze Runner. Scorch Trials look fucking amazing, by the way. It's epic. But anyway, he ended up directing something else, but he'd gotten in the door. And those shorts are great, but
they bought the rights to Ruin as well.
No, they did. Yeah. And maybe he'll make it eventually.
Yeah, but I think they're going to make it probably when he finishes the franchise.
Totally. Well, now he's got another one set up.
Yeah, he has to.
Yeah. The Northern...
He's got too much on his plate already.
Yeah.
But he told me, he's like, Ruin is going to be my Star Wars. Right? So maybe heavy metal will be your Star Wars in a way. Yeah.
Maybe. I had another film at Fox called Rockfish, which was a short film we did. Actually, it was the first... It was the second. We had a little short film contest every year early on in Blur, and it was one of the traditions I still wish we could do. We just can't afford to do it anymore, but we would do a short film every year. And we did one for fun the first year called Aunt Louisa that I wrote and directed. And then the second year we had a competition.
Was it live action or?
No, it was animation. And it got shortlisted for the Oscar nominations.
Oh, nice.
And then we said, hey, this is pretty cool.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I remember that.
And then I did Rockfish, which I wrote and directed. Kevin worked on that. It was like one of the first things he did here at the studio. And it got shortlisted as well. And then we did Go for Broke, which one of our other directors, Jeff Fowler, did.
Right.
And that got nominated. Then we had another one called In the Rough, and then we wanted to continue doing it. It's just a huge expense to do.
Yeah,
you know, Pixar level. Well, I'm being grandiose there,
right.
But high quality animation and in your spare time,
right? But people are doing it, you know. You know, people are looking at even Construct that Kevin's doing. You know, it's like holy crap, you know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But Kevin is. He's a monster.
He is.
Yeah.
He is, because I've...
Gentleman's Duel. That was the other one.
I just... The way that Kevin works is like, not only is he just not giving up, but he tends to try to keep himself completely organized at the same time. It's really kind of beautiful to see. It's been a pleasure to like help him out, because I can be a bunch of people like, well, you know, I don't know, I'm not going to get to it right now. It's like Kevin's like, all right, we're going to do this, going to do that, I'm going to have this, going to do that, and he does it, and he just executes, and he's like, I need, and he has vision that I'm like, I want to help you with your vision, tell me what I can do. So I'm really happy about working with him on Construct.
So smart.
Yeah,
you know, there's another has Kevin done a podcast?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's a director named Nick Matthew, who I was actually talking to him on the phone when you came in.
Okay.
He's directing a film for Legendary, and I think you should do a little podcast with with Nick. Super smart guy.
Get me in touch with him.
But talk about analytical and organized, and you know, he was doing another project when I met him. David Fincher introduced me to him, and man, I just fell in love with the guy. He's so smart. And I'd just never seen that level of focus, organization, understanding of the process as a whole that he had. It was really kind of, you know, every once in a while it's daunting. You look at guys and you just go, fuck, he's so much better than me. Why is that, you know? And then you just, you got to get past the jealousy and
yes.
and to enjoy just how great somebody is.
Yeah. I had a similar situation when I was back when I was in architecture school, and I was doing some very early, it was, you know, around 1993 is when I started doing CG and architecture, which was like, whoa, you know. And I got really into it, and I got architecture, CG, and visualization, and I started doing a lot of animations and weird stuff in architecture. And right around that same time, there's another guy, you know, from Columbia who was doing the same thing, and sort of at SIGGRAPH, or like looking at the same thing, and it's like, well, that guy got to direct Tron. Joe. and then I'm working for him on Tron. So it's like, okay, that's fine. And he's a super nice guy. So I can't wish him ill will because I love working on his projects and they're great. But you know, like, you know, every now and then it's like, all right, so Joe Kaczynski, he was doing stuff at Columbia when I was doing stuff at Rice, and it was really cool and was sort of comparing what he was doing. And now he's like, all right.
It's funny you say that about Joe. He's a great guy. We've worked on a couple of projects together, right. But I had that same feeling when, you know, the Halo commercial that he did.
Yes.
That was really like a breakout spot for him. Blur was going to do that commercial.
Yes.
And at the last minute, it was taken away, and Joe did it. And I'd be lying if I said I wasn't really, really bitter for a while there, because it really got such exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And you know Joe well enough to know if it hadn't been that, it would have been something else next week or something else the week after,
sure.
Because he's just that fucking good.
Right.
But at the time I was really like, fuck, it could have been me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't.
He's a really cool guy.
Oh, he's a great guy.
We're coming near.
Also very analytical, very smart.
Oh yeah,
knows his.
He's the only director. Shit. I've said this before. He's the only director who goes into the screening room and looks at stuff. He's like, well, that's really cool. What was your noise threshold on that render? Because he knows that.
Yeah, I know. It's great. Well, yeah. Nick, you'll like Nick.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'll hit you up for his email so I can get in touch with him. It coming towards the end, but I want to cover one more thing because I think. I'd love to hear your voice on this specific subject. And I've asked people like Wes and other people about how they feel about it. Recently in the popular press, there's been this big backlash against CG. And it's unbelievably frustrating to me. And I'd like to hear what you think about it and why you think this is happening. So you know what I'm talking about, the backlash against CG?
Yeah, and somebody did a really... Who was it? Somebody did a really amazing rebuttal.
Yes, it was called CG Sucks Except It Doesn't or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And I said it much better than I ever could.
But right.
I just think it's beyond ridiculous. I mean, CG's not making movies bad. Before bad CG can happen, a bad script has to happen.
Yes.
So are we suddenly... Is it just a surplus of bad scripts that's creating bad CG? Is it just people being unfettered from restrictions? I still don't think that on the fundamental level it's bad taste.
Mm-hmm.
That has nothing to do with CG. You know, you can create something bad in any medium,
right?
Whether it's a painting, a story, or CG, it comes down to. It comes down to story and character for me, but also the artists themselves, right?
Right. So one of the things that I was saying is that the problem is that if you do CG really well, you don't even know it's there,
yeah.
Right? And that's kind of sucks for the artist because we are so proud when no one can tell that there's CG in the shot, which is kind of a weird thing, right? I did such a good job that no one knows I did anything.
Yeah, I don't think that's such a weird thing, though. I mean, there's as you know, and I do too, there's a skill to matching into reality with a whole set of tools that happen inside a box with electrons and light. And you're proud of that. Not everybody can do that. Not everybody has the eye for... achieving that level of invisibility. And
mm-hmm.
and so why shouldn't you be proud of that?
Right.
I think that's a class of CG. You know, that's a section of CG. Then you have stuff like Guardians of the Galaxy where you're creating aliens and spaceships and shit that is very obviously a visual effect.
Yes, yes. But so one of the reasons I wanted to bring it up with you is because a lot of the work that has been done at Blur... is all CG, right? Mm-hmm. And is celebrated as looking amazing, right? And so why is CG suck if an all CG shot, which you obviously know is all CG, looks amazing? And I think that there's this blame of like, oh, well, CG is like it's all. But it's not. When I saw one, you know, it was a few years ago, obviously now, which seems weird it was a few years ago, but when I saw the Elder Scrolls stuff that you guys did, I was like, what? It was amazing. I was like...
Thanks to V-Ray.
I was like, I was like, which part of it is live action? I was trying to figure out which part of it was live action. I just, I had a hard time accepting that it was all CG for a lot of it. And I knew it's like, obviously some of it has to be CG, but the characters were well done. Everything was well done. The hair, the animation was really rich. Everything was working. It's like, CG doesn't suck. And CG is a beautiful thing because it's an artist's tool set, and he shouldn't look at it as a thing. You should look at it as a group of talented people made this, and that's what you should celebrate it, and not the box that it, that made it, right?
Yeah, I almost think you give too much credit to the people that maybe said that to begin with,
right,
to dignify that. It's not even worth really the discussion, right?
But it's happening all the time, and I'm hearing so many people. You know, there was a podcast on The Verge, and these are technology people, right? And they're like saying, it's like, oh well, you know, CG is just like, it's just gotten so bad now. And, you know, it was so cool. You know, it's like, now that I think that the studios are starting to understand that they need to do more practical stuff. I mean, just look at, Mad Max. I'm like, you know what's amazing about Mad Max is that on that frame, half of it is CG and half of it is live action, and you can't tell which one is which. And that's amazing to me.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's going to be the same with Star Wars. I mean, I think J.J. gets a lot of press over the, we're going to do it the old school way, we're right, going to do it. But at the end of the day, really, who cares?
Right.
All I care is the image that's on the screen. I don't really care how you got it there.
Right.
I care. Let me rephrase that. I care that you got it there the best looking, most efficient way. Like, I remember, I'm not even going to say the film, but some director that the visual effects was in the Bake Off, and this director had a rule that 50% of every frame had to be CG. And then you talk to the artists about that, and the visual effects were great, by the way, in this movie. And you talk to the artists, and they're like, "Holy shit, we had to jump through hoops to make sure that, you know, 50% of." Sometimes it wasn't 50%, but we said it was 50%, and all these hoops to satisfy this incredibly ridiculous rule that 50%
seems very arbitrary.
It seems so incredibly arbitrary. And I mean, I can understand the place where that would come from, where a director would say that is, you know, to sort of rein in rampant runaway visual effects, maybe. But still, in a perfect world, or even in a non-perfect world, what you want to say is, use a proper tool for the job.
Right.
If it should be all CG, then it should be all CG.
Right.
I'd be lying if I didn't say we run into it on our films where I'm very comfortable with all CG.
Sure.
And so you just got to say, what's the best way to do this?
Right.
What's the best cost analysis for quality analysis? You know, sometimes it means practical, sometimes it means CG. And I think you pool the collective experience of the people on the set that are in charge of those things, and in that case, me and mm-hmm. our visual effects supervisor and our stunt guys, and say, you know, what's the best way? Here's what I want to do. Here's my vision, mm-hmm. in quotation marks, for the shot. And let's figure out how to get there the most efficient way.
Right.
You know? So CG or not CG, really, it's kind of irrelevant. You know, it's all there to serve the story. And if your story sucks, your CG is going to suck.
Or sometimes the story sucks and the movie sucks, and the only thing that's saving it is the CG, and people complain about it. The CG may be very good, and then it complains, it's a terrible movie, so it's the CG is the problem. It's like, no.
Right. Like we, you know, which brings us full circle, the right. Final Fantasy thing,
right,
where I said people are going to blame this on the fact that the movie was CG and,
right,
and adult, whereas really it sucks because it was a bad story.
Right.
You know, if you had done that same, like, I agree with you, it was amazing and it did amazing things for the industry, but imagine if that much artistry at the time had been in service of a great story,
mm-hmm.
it could have really launched a much more aggressive thrust into photoreal adult CG stories, and
right,
we'd be even further along.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, things aren't clipping along well.
Now. No, no, no. It's a different world now, and I think it's good. I'm just trying to, I, I believe that VFX is getting a bad rap, and there's a lack of respect that's happening. And I feel that some of the older guys like me in the industry feel a little bit like, you know, I don't think you guys understand what we do, and you guys are just saying, oh, it's all just CG now. And I hate that term. I hate it. It's like, oh, those guys just do it all in CG now. It sucks. And it just really frustrates me, because I think we need to get more respect out of the general press, you know? And I think there's some really good talent out there. And you know this for a fact, because you spend a lot of the hires that come to Blur is you going onto forums and seeing people on 3D Total or whatever else is going on. And you basically go to those sites and you say, that artist, you know, I want to talk to that guy. And it's not, you're not going there as like, I need a lighter and just hire some random lighter, right? You're looking at individuals and looking at the artistry. And so
that's my superpower.
Yeah. That is a superpower, right?
So. Yeah. Well, identifying other talented artists who will come work for me, make me look good, and ultimately I'll take credit for their work.
Sure.
That's
you're giving them
my evil master plan.
You give them a haven. Right? So that's what happens, is that they feel a good, safe environment to work in, and it's like they're amongst people just like themselves, and it's a very good place to work. So I think it's really nice.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I don't, I think there is, I mean, I feel like there's respect for visual effects artists out there in the world. I think it's a changing dynamic. I mean, I think here in Los Angeles, it feels a little grim sometimes where, mm-hmm. you know, I moved out here because this was the pinnacle of the world mm-hmm. for computer graphics 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's hard for me to step back, and even when it hurts my own company, and be objective, but I have to, and say, well, it's time for the rest of the world to get their share of that, and we don't have a corner on the market of quality artists or people with vision or talent, so why shouldn't it be spread around? And you know, on some level, I'm not even angry about the tax incentives and all of that. It's mm-hmm. it's business, and anybody that expects this business to be exempt from the forces that affect every other business in the universe I just don't see it
right
ever happening. I wish it didn't have to happen. Mm-hmm. I really do. It'd be better for me and my family and all the people that work here. But you know, it happens with automobiles. It happens with speakers. It happens with Dixie cups. It's just
yeah. I understand.
It's a commodity.
I mean, it's and I. Talent is, you know, the thing is, if you work in visual effects, you work for a big, you know, cool company. I mean, this is talent from all over the world. It always has been. When the first room I worked at a digital domain, I was the only American in the room. Okay. So everyone else was on visas. I'm sure you have a handful of people on visas here, right? And that's because you have to pool from the entire world. You can't just say, I'm just going to hire Americans or people from Los Angeles, even for that.
I just look for the best people. And
right.
If they happen to be not here, then
that's where we look for them.
I'm as patriotic as the next guy, but right. ultimately what I'm really believing in is talent, and not you know, where you grew up. I don't think it matters. I mean, fuck, I was in Canada for 6 months working. And you know, the funny thing is, you think about visual effects in our industry, and it's become very itinerant workforce in a lot of ways, and it's sad for people because they feel like they can't put down roots and raise their family, and I have a lot of sympathy for that. But among this live action group of people, I mean, what's happening to our industry happened to theirs years ago, and
they just have to go to wherever
for
6
and
months.
They don't even, it's not even a topic of conversation anymore. It's just the way, that's what you have to do. If you, you go here and work, and then you go over there and work, and then you go over to this place and work, and they, you know, it's just become the way things are.
Right.
And so to even talk about what's going on in our visual effects industry now, or has been for a while, it's almost like they don't understand. Well, of course, that's,
it's always been that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway,
that's okay. All right. I don't want to get it too long, so I'm going to end the podcast now, but I really appreciate you coming by and or me having the time to do this because I am doing it at the Blur office. But it was really great and very insightful. You were very great and just speaking your mind, and I love that. It's exactly what I wanted in this podcast, people to hear Tim Miller talk. So
I'll probably be sorry when I hear Tim Miller talk later. I'm always going, fuck, why did I say that? But I really appreciate it. And you know, aside from this, I really appreciate, I mean, Chaos Group's been great to us, and V-Ray is a pretty important part of what we do, so thank you for creating it.
Yeah. We just like the fact that we're just a few blocks away, right? And so that's been a really nice thing to just be able to pop by. I mean, I feel very welcome the minute I walk in, but he's like, gives me a big hug, you know? So it's really a very welcoming place, you know? And Kevin comes by all the time because he needs to borrow a graphics card or whatever.
I know. It's really nice. The best thing about having a studio is that feeling when you walk in every day and everybody's just getting coffee and you know them, and it's great. And which is why I really love the all staff model that, you know, we've stepped back from a little bit, but you know, it was really important to me for the first 15, 18 years of the company that I really loved. I wanted to hire people and have them work for me forever because you get used to people and you like them and you understand what they want. And if you understand what an artist likes to work on, then and you can give him that, and it's so great because he's happy, he produces better work. It's so much, you know, it's this beautiful cycle.
Right.
With the more itinerant workforce, it's interesting in a different way. You get a lot of fresh perspectives and you meet a lot of new people, but it's never quite the same as, you know, working with a group of friends that you've gone through a few fires with and know, trust and love. And, you know, it's different. It's still good, but it's different. And I really like that. That's the best thing I like about Blur, and is the family aspect of it.
And has working on the film been a challenge to you because you haven't been able to deal with it as much day to day, or?
It was, but surprisingly, not at all. I mean, I've been trying to do this for a long time, so my wife was ready for me to do it, and she was already really running the business side of things, and so she really just stepped up and said, "Look, I got your back. Go and do this." And you know, Dave Wilson, who's one of our directors, has been here for a long time, was a CG supervisor, and or was an artist, and then a CG supervisor, and then a director. Mm-hmm. And Dave's amazing. He's done, I think, probably the best work here, and so Dave stepped up and said, "Yeah, I'll take over creative director duties." Mm-hmm. And then everybody else, all the other directors, Kevin started directing, and you know, everybody else sort of stepped up, and the company's done better than it did when I was sitting in the chair full time. Although now I'm back, you know, and I'm sitting in my same chair I sat in for years before.
Right.
But I feel like I had this little adventure off in Canada, and now it's sort of back to normal. Although, you know, I'm still here, but I'm doing Deadpool within the studio.
Within the studio. Well, that's really nice that they allowed you to sort of do it within your home.
Yeah, you know? So efficient.
Yeah.
You know, Jennifer built me this nice little Premiere editing, the edit bay, and the bays for the assistant editors, very comfortable.
Yeah.
And then we're running Blur's doing a chunk of the effects, but then we have Digital Domain and Atomic Fiction and Luma. Weta's doing some stuff now. We have a lot of different vendors doing sequences for us all over the world, and we're trying to, you know, manage that process from here. Fox has been very good about letting us do that.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
It's great for me.
I
just stroll up to VFX and look at cool shit, and then I stroll into editorial and look at cool shit. It's great for me.
Very cool. All right, well, I'm gonna let you go so you can to it, but thanks so much, Tim. And what I usually say is we let the last bucket drop, which is the last bucket on the render. So
all right.
All right.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Bye.